You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, October 14th, 2012, and this is the Webcomic Beacon Newscast with, from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Greetings and salutations, Internet.
From EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Terry.
Hello.
And from 910CMX, it's 910Comics.com, I'm Thomas Revor. And here's the news. We want to go ahead and open up today because our top story being Comixology, the Android and iPhone app, which is being used by a lot of the major publishers, is now opening up to small publishers as well and self-publishers. They are opening up a new portal called the Comixology Submit. Now, right now, the site is in private beta test, but eventually anyone with a comic short story, serialized narrative, graphic novel, anything of that type will be able to upload a PDF of their work, have it approved by the company's team of content reviewers, and it will be available for purchase through Comixology. They're talking about a split being a 50-50 split on self-published comics, 50% going to you, 50% going to them, after any additional fees, such as the 30% that Apple takes out of any ebook or thing like that. So we'll have more information about that. Take a look at the link that we'll have over on the web. And, of course, that comes to us from Comic Book Resources. Now, one of those things that always is hard to do is when we do an obituary, and we've had some in recent times of some of the big or forgotten names in the print comic world. Well, one came to us that was neither big nor print comic. A good friend of ours, Isaku, who did the webcomic Discordia, and who I was fortunate enough to work with for a filler over for The Watch, has passed away. I've asked Ben Carver from the Animation Aficionados podcast, who is also a very good friend of his, to come in and tell us a little bit about what happened. Ben?
Okay, this is really hard for me still. He died last Sunday. He had a stroke. He had a pre-existing condition, a high blood pressure, and he was trying to combat it. He really was the kind of guy that didn't want anyone to think that anything was wrong. I kept on, you know, if he told me, I would have done anything to help him with it. And but, you know, it's the hardest thing. It's, you know, I never met him in person, but I felt like I knew him for a long time because he's someone that I could talk to about pretty much anything. And he is someone who I felt really understood me. And, you know, he was a Hispanic artist. He lived in Mexico City. He was in his early 30s. He was a great collaborator. I worked with him on many different things, or even just asked his opinion on stuff. He did the Friday updates for my other webcomic, Hero Academy, heroacademy.comicgenesis.com, if you want to see his work. And he also contributed many guest pages on Crossover Kill, the superhero webcomic crossover extravaganza with that has different contributors like Neil Purcell of Dossian, Al Schroeder of Mind Mistress, you know, great bunch of people there, and they all were shocked as much as I was hearing this last Wednesday. It was, you know, caught me by surprise. As Tom mentioned, he did do Discordia, and you know, last time I talked to him, he was talking about starting it over again, you know, continuing it because you know it drew me in. That's probably the comic that made me want to contact him and many years ago, and that's how we became friends. It's he had a very distinctive art style. He was a great artist, but he always had a very humble, almost low opinion of himself, and I kept on having to tell him, "No, you're good. You're really good." It's hard. I miss him still.
I was talking with his co-collaborator on Discordia, Wraith, who also does High School Changed Me and MSF High. And he was actually talking with Isaku the Saturday before he died about the two of them restarting Discordia. So it was a very sudden and very shocking death, and all of those who knew him missed him. And God bless him and his family and everybody else who knew him. We'll be keeping Discordia up over on the 910 site at discordiacomic.com. But
I appreciate it, and then he would too.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thank you. Thank you, and I think he would really have loved to have known how much he was loved in the community, or just people who just loved his artwork, because, you know, he never thought he was good enough, and I always thought he was.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Ben. And let's get back to something that's hopefully a little more cheery. Well, it's Eric, so we don't know about that. Eric, you've got the buzz to this week. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what's happening?
Well, I wouldn't say the buzz is cheery, but if you want to switch to an emotion of anger, the buzz is for you this week. Our first article comes to us from IndieWeek.com, and this is a interview with the creator of Pearls Before Swine, Stefan Fatz. Now, Stefan Fatz is a print comic publisher, but he did start out as a webcomic publisher, although he started out in a sort of weird spot in that his webcomic was sponsored by a syndicate in 2000. When it became popular, his comic was then moved to print syndication, and he's been doing print syndication ever since. In the article, Stefan is lamenting the death of the syndicates and the death of the print publisher. One of the comments that has sort of gotten the web up in arms recently is the comment when he talks about going to webcomics. And he says, quote, Now to make it, you have to go the web route. Many of those guys, Penny Arcade, Cyanide and Happiness, to Perry Bible Fellowship, which are all excellent, claim to make a living. But how do you know? There has been a bit of outcry against this on various sources. Depending on the particular, your particular point of view, if it's a print comic, it's something that shows that the web is not to fruition. The webcomic sources have been quite infuriated by this comment. We'll be continuing to follow this story and see what happens in the future. Our next article in Buzz comes to us from Comic Beat. And this is Peraz and Governor are launching a new think tank. Now, Peraz is the guy that worked for DC Comics and was one of the driving forces behind Zuda. They are now launching what is called a webcomic think tank. And this is along the same lines of, we've got to figure out how this web thing works. So they have a webcomic think tank. They're also featuring a open source comic reader, which works with all current browsers and was developed specifically for digital comics. They are trying to come up with new ideas on how to monetize comics and how to move into the future. And this is their first foray into that realm. Our third article in Buzz this week comes to us from Comics Beat, and this is talking about Shifty Look. This is the webcomic company started up by Namco, the video game company, and talking about Ryan North and Chris Hastings are going to create a new Galaga comic. What it's about and how it will work, we're not quite sure, but it's a big announcement, taking two webcomic professionals to create a brand new comic. That's what we got for Buzz this week. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Eric. And while I go and listen to some of my Buckner and Garcia, let's see, you old people recognize that reference. Marie, you've got our business this week. We've got something that actually sounds and makes me a little happy to hear. What have we got?
Well, we only have one story, but it's actually kind of uplifting. Our story comes to us from GigaOhm.com, and it's a story about internet advertising. Specifically, that internet advertising is still a growing business and still is actually getting bigger. It hasn't increasing as much as over 2011, according to the article, but they attribute that to the rather poor economy in 2010 and the subsequent recovery in 2011 being responsible for a rather sort of blip of growth and then slowing down a little bit as the overall larger economy has sort of struggled a little bit in 2012. So, but it looks like, and this is good news for all of us who make any sort of ad revenue, that it is still a growing business and it is still getting bigger. So, and it is still definitely looking like it's healthy. So that's good to know. If you want to know more about specific details, do check out the link in the show notes. And that's all there is in business. So back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Marie. At this point, we're going to go ahead and head back over to Eric, who's got something to teach us. Well, at least something in teaching. What do we have in education today, Eric?
We got two stories in education this week. The first one is pretty technical, coming to us from our friend Kleefeld, and is from his blog Kleefeld on Comics. And this is from the website, and I got to spell this out, emaki.net. And this is a pretty technical article talking about the time to comprehend a comic panel. Now, this is an article about how long it takes the average viewer to read a comic panel, and it shows that the time to comprehend a comic panel is actually kind of longer than we expected, and talks a little bit about the scientific method to discover this. Now, while it doesn't seem to greatly relate to our field, it does talk about the time people have to spend on your site to actually understand your comics, and it seems that you need to keep people there a little longer to get it to actually work. The second article comes to us from geeknews.mtv.com, also written by Sean Kleefeld this week, and it's a small article on picking a name for your comic. It talks about how to pick a name that is both memorable and unique, but not so unique that no one can find it. Talks about some of the common names and how they're used and how you can make naming your comic a bigger part of your business. That's what we got for education. Back to you, Tom.
And nobody sees the irony of Eric. I used to write Excern. Kimball reading that last story.
At the time, things would have been a lot different.
Of course, I will say I learned everything I need to know about comprehending comic panels, like never tell a story about your comic on a panel when Kitty Hawk is showing slides on a projector.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks.
But let's go ahead and go over to something a little more serious. Marie, you've got our legal, and darn it, we don't have anything from Charles Carrion this week.
No, thank goodness. But we do have two stories. Both of them have to do somewhat with sort of internet rights. Our first one, if you haven't heard about it, it's been making the rounds on Twitter and through the various social medias. It is coming to us from GigaOhm.com via GigaOhm.com from NewStatesman.com about a debate regarding free speech versus decency on Reddit. I hope I said that right.
Reddit,
yes, on Reddit. And basically, broken down to a nutshell, what's been going on is that there is a section on Reddit called Creeper Photos, where basically people, specifically men, are taking pictures of women. I don't know if any women are participating in this, but generally speaking, it seems to be a trend, as mostly male, are taking pictures of women without their consent, not necessarily illegal photos of them. They are clothed, but there's some suggestions that there may have been some that are a little iffy, like trying to get under their dresses and so forth. With cell phones and things on crowded trains and so on. And they post these pictures without their consent. Well, it looks like somebody saw this and got upset about it. A woman got upset about this and basically wanted to do something about it. And they wouldn't do anything about it, even though they had blocked a news all edits or all links from a news source, which hadn't posted some, they were afraid they were going to post something negative and they never actually did, but they still blocked it. About stopping these people from posting these creepy photos. So she created a Tumblr blog called Predators and basically outed the men who were taking these pictures and caused this huge flare up of basically invasion of privacy, blah, 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 which was obviously kind of, There's a sort of an irony there in the sense that they're posting these pictures of women without their permission. Many of them, some of them show faces and could easily glean identities from, whereas they're posting information that is freely available on the internet. This is like Facebook profiles, Twitter profiles, LinkedIn profiles kind of thing. This is stuff that's already out there, Tumblr profiles, and basically putting it up there, stuff that they had said, stuff about their families, whatever. And basically this is turning into a giant thing between their privacy being invaded versus what they were doing. So the debate continues on exactly what should be done about this. If you want to know in detail what's going on, do check out the link in the show notes. The second of our stories today comes to us from GigaOhm.com, and it is about the UK jailing of internet trolls. Yes, folks, if you're a troll in the UK, you could be in big trouble. But it looks like they might be, there is a hint that they may be coming to their senses about this. It's not necessarily illegal to be a jerk or a tasteless jerk, but there are people in the UK who have actually been jailed and fined as a result of being a troll online. There's a very interesting look at it. It's short, but it's interesting that there are there's five cases that are cited on the site regarding different circumstances who are people who were either jailed or sentenced to community service for anything about from racist tweets to making jokes about a missing girl on Twitter to basically insulting soldiers in Afghanistan, killed in Afghanistan, or referring to a local official as a womanly body part that is socially unacceptable. So if you'd like to see more about how the UK is treating these trolls and how they may or may not come to their senses regarding regarding internet punishment and justice in the real world, check out the link in the show notes. And that's everything that there is in the legal section. Back to you, Tom.
I smell a discussion topic.
Maybe. And Tom cancels his trip's plans to the UK.
Hey, it only says jail. It does not say execution yet. But that brings it back to me. I've got the tidbits this week, and we're going to go ahead and open up with a story, well, more of an article from Brad Feld over at Feld.com, talking about the power of a deadline. For all of us in the webcomic world, well, most of us, the word deadline can put us into cold sweats and shaking hands, because those things are when we have to get the workout done. Feld actually talks about some of the more positive things that can result because of a deadline. It's definitely one of those things that everybody should look at to see some of the more positive points of such a negative thing. Next, over at bleedingcool.com, I had to take the story, and that is the first issue of a new comic being published from our friends at IDW Comics has sold over 90,000 copies before it has even come out on the shelves. Is it Transformers or G.I. Joe, their big cash cows? No. It's My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. That's right. The 90,000 pre-orders that have been issued for it have not only caused its release date to be pushed back a month, since they didn't have enough issues printed for this, it has also make it selling better than Marvel's Uncanny X-Men, the undisputed king of sales for a long, long time. More power to you, and more power to the bronies. But at this point, I think that's it. We've got Marie for our oddities, and Marie, back over to you.
One article in the oddities section, and this is for anybody who's a Lord of the Rings fan. If you've ever wanted to know some obscure, strange statistics about the world of Lord of the Rings, this is the site that you want to check out, the LOTRproject.com. And basically this site is got a whole bunch of interesting information compiled with all the different characters and everything in the books, from everything from like the races and sexual demographics, that apparently in Middle Earth, it's 81% male and 19% female. The life expectancies of the various races and at the various time zones, age distribution, population, the longevity decline, extremes, time distance. There's a whole bunch of different ones. They're lovely graphics, they little graphs and stuff that go with this. And it's a really interesting little read. So if you are a Lord of the Rings fan, go check it out, because I think you'll be highly amused. And that's everything from the oddities. Back to you, Tom.
I'm sure one piece of information it does not have is how Ralph Bakshi was able to get the rights to publish the Lord of the Rings movie way back in the day. But before our break, we've got one last piece, and that is one of our long contributing associates, Alex Heberling, has decided to step back from the podcast and will no longer be joining us here at the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. She shipped Fess over a recording as to saying goodbye to everybody, so now we're going to hand it over to Fess to play that recording.
Hi, everyone. This is Alex Heberling, here to let you know that I've decided to leave the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. Sad, I know. It's been an honor to be part of the newscast since the very beginning of the show, almost 2 years ago, but I am leaving it in the very capable hands of Tom, Eric, Jason, Typhon, Dean, and all the rest of our regular guests and commentators. As always, I am at Alex Heberling on Twitter if you want to follow me, and you can read my comic, Alex's Guide to a Life Well Lived, at alexesguide.net. If I had actually stuck with a catchphrase to close out the show with, I would say it here, but alas. See you around.
Speaking on behalf of everybody from here at the Webcomic Beacon Newscast, I want to thank Alex for her long term. I mean, she was doing this before I joined on board, and we're all going to miss her here. So thank you for all the hard work, Alex, and hopefully you'll come back every once in a while to join us as a contributor. And at this point, we'll be back with our discussion panel right after this.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. It's time for our discussion period. And joining me today are, from BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Greetings.
From EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Terry.
Hello.
And from Moonbase Press, John Lotshaw.
Hey, howdy, hey.
And we're going to go ahead and start off today with the story about Reddit. Now, I actually see there's some comparisons and some similarities between this story and the UK jail story. So we're going to kind of group those together. But I actually see this being two stories just on Reddit alone. The first is, of course, the story about Reddit blocking links from the Gawker network because of the items being posted over there. But we also have to talk about the original story, which is, what do we think about the items that are being posted over on Reddit itself?
See, I mean, there. Here's the thing. It's the internet. You kind of have to expect that sort of thing. And if it isn't posted on Reddit, it's posted on a million other places. I don't know. I mean, I guess I've become desensitized to it, because yes, it is illegal and invading people's privacies, but at the same time, I'm used to the internet doing this.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. You may be desensitized to it, but the law isn't. And the law says that you cannot post, you cannot use someone's image without their express permission. That's why we have to have clearances for even for things like showing up on the news. I'm sure that even the Obama phone lady had to sign a waiver to allow her image to be on the news report that went viral. This is we do have laws about invasion of privacy, and just because the internet does it and it's on a million sites, it doesn't make it ill, doesn't make it legal. And what Reddit is doing is they are protecting themselves, because if they don't, then they are abrogating their corporate responsibility, their responsibility to the owners of the company and the shareholders, if it's public. I don't know if it's public or not, but they're abrogating that responsibility to protect themselves, to actively protect themselves against legal action. They're not going to be able to do it, be 100% successful, but they have to, where they know that there's a problem, they have to step in and take steps. And that's exactly what's happened here.
Well, let me add a couple of pieces of information into this, because these subforums, or subreddits as they're called over in Reddit, are actually two specific ones as to what they're doing, one of which are the sexualized pictures of women, but there's also another one which is sexualized pictures of women under the age of 18, under the age of consent. And
technically, that's child pornography. Yep. Technically, that's child pornography.
Well, yes. Sexualized and
sexualizing images of children is child pornography, and they when they come after you for that, they take your computers away, they lock them away in rooms where only very certain people can the forensic scientists can go in and deconstruct the evidence. They take that extremely seriously.
Now, Marie, as our resident woman, let's get your opinion on this whole thing.
Well, I mean, for me, I agree that being working in graphic design and working with photography and stuff, yes, you do need to have permission to publicly post images taken of a person. I know it does happen. People will post images on Facebook or whatever, people maybe in a crowd or in a public place. Although if you are in a public place, I know there, at least in Canada, there is, I know there's like a provision in the law that says that, you know, if you're in a place that has like cameras and as a public place, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy, and therefore if you are photographed in a public place, that there's actually this sort of this legal niggle about that you don't necessarily yes. have anything that you can complain about. Now, what I think is really, I mean, it is especially from a woman's point of view, an incredibly creepy and neurotic thing to think that, you know, you're on the transit, you're, you know, going somewhere, and that somebody is, you know, there's somebody that could be sneaking up, trying to get a look under your skirt, or trying to take pictures of your crotch, or trying to, you know, cop a feel or whatever.
And that's,
you know,
the difference. And that's the difference. You were talking about being in places where there are cameras and a reasonable expectation of privacy. What that exemption is for things like security cameras that are operated by the government, that are operated by the owners of the facility, and they are not for the purpose of commercializing those images. Those images are being captured for very specific purposes. They're being for public safety purposes. They're not being captured to go and put them up on Facebook just because somebody makes a goofy face, or somebody the wind catches somebody's skirts and you can see their undies. That's the difference. It does not extend to people, to the guy standing next to you on the train who grabs his iPhone and snaps a picture of you.
And let's go ahead and add one other piece in there, because if these are common, ordinary, everyday people photos are being taken care of, being taken.
Here,
we've got the same thing occurring with the paparazzi as well. And so many people say that's okay because they're already in the public eye. But the same argument that's being made for the people, the celebrities who are being hounded by paparazzi, can be made for these things as well.
Okay, but here's where I want to bring the England story in on this. Because in England, there are pretty strict rules about libel, in the fact that you can be sued for simply saying, I don't like this person's work. And the internet troll things, they're throwing people in jail for jokes. I mean, this started off with someone making a joke about how bad the airport was, and he had to go through a whole legal process. But that's legally the laws of England. So, yet again, the place I start to get nervous is when you say, well, they're breaking the law, so therefore these people should be outed. That makes me uncomfortable, because sometimes the laws are unjust in countries. And sometimes people live in countries where they are not, where you don't want to be a part of outing these people. And yeah, this whole thing that they were doing is really repulsive, but at the same time, I always get very uncomfortable when the response to someone's doing something we don't like, so let's reveal their identity. That makes me really nervous, because
I don't think
I agree that is going that's going too far. I think the way to handle them is to shut them down. Is to cut off that account. Yeah, they'll come back, but that's the way to handle it.
And if you have their identity, there are legal methods. I mean, they'd be outed anyway when you bring out a suit against them through civil court.
But I mean, this is what happened with Reddit. Someone didn't like what was happening on Reddit, so she threatened to reveal the identity of the moderators. That would open up the moderators to legal actions. Now, granted, what the moderators were doing and what the Reddit was doing was repulsive. But that option of saying, you're doing something I don't like, so I'm going to out you and expose you to the laws of a state, that makes me uncomfortable.
A similar situation with something that's outside of the story, is that there was a website from a church group here in Texas that would go around to a lot of the adult stores, quote unquote, and take pictures of the license plates and the people coming out of there and post them on their page.
Right.
That's completely legal on both aspects. I mean, going into an adult store down here in Texas is legal if you're of age. But taking pictures of these things, of the people coming out and taking pictures of their license plates, that's also legal. You know, she did, if she had proof and was saying that these were the people in there, whether they were moderators or the people posting this stuff, it's still within the bounds of the law. But the people who are posting some of these things, some of them were outside of the law and should have been taken care of. Was this the proper way of doing it? No.
Yeah.
I
think the outing, and yet again, we keep on getting stories like this of someone doing something horrible, and so people of the internet come together and out this person, and that silences them. We had a story a little while back where someone was sending harassing emails to female comic creators, and so the people got together and outed them, and outed this individual, and that stopped the harassment, and it was... You know, we can all say, great, we stopped this horrible person. But it just makes me uncomfortable, that precedent. That every time someone does something you don't like, the way is to publicly shame them. It makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, Gawker Media is a company that is known for its flaunting of the law anyway. As you may recall, they were the ones that were involved in the whole stolen iPhone debacle that happened iPhone 4 prototype. And they knew they had in their hands a stolen piece of property that they were technically in violation of the law in being a theft by receiving, and they went ahead and went with the story anyway. So this company has a history of saying, we don't care what the law says, we're going to go and do it however we want. And so I think that the Reddit was it was just a bad situation overall. Reddit shouldn't have been in the business of posting these pictures in the first place.
Yeah.
But Gawker is a loose cannon, and I have, and you know, full disclosure, I love IO9. I think that's a great blog, but the rest of the company, sometimes their journalistic standards are right up there with William Randolph Hearst.
But let's go ahead and we're going to talk a little bit more about our second topic, the jail terms. Over in the UK, but I want to give this last bit of news on the Reddit story, and that is both of the subreddits, which we talked about, the r jailbait and r creep shots, have been deleted. The r jailbait was deleted in a cull, as they say, of similarly pedophilic subreddits back in August of last year, which also took down other ones such as R Teen Girls and R Jailbait GW, like Girls Gone Wild. And the second was made private and then deleted due to the fallout of Adrian Chen, the Gawker.com's journalist, investigation. So, I mean, at least something happened that was more positive for that. Now, these sites have been recreated and redeleted and recreated and deleted as they're going to be. It's up to Reddit to handle that type of stuff at this point. But it'll be interesting to see what happens on this. Now, over to the second one. That was the jail terms for trolls over in the United Kingdom. The UK does have something laws that state that when something is deemed, quote, grossly offensive, that you can be arrested and jailed. And that is what's happened on this. Some of the items which were included were Matthew Wood, who made a joke on Facebook about a missing 5-year-old girl who is whose name was April Jones and is presumed dead. Azhar Ahmed, who was sentenced on Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday, to 240 hours community service because he had said nasty things also on Facebook about soldiers who had been killed in Afghanistan, such as he said soldiers should, quote, die and go to hell. John Curlin, who was sentenced to 80 hours unpaid work in May for referring to a local official as the derogatory name for a certain female body part. Joshua Cryer, who was given 2 weeks of community service in March for racially abusing, their phrase, racially abusing the soccer player Stan Collymore over Twitter. And Liam Stacey, who was sentenced in March to 56 days in jail for making racist tweets when soccer player Fabrice Muamba collapsed on the field. Now, it seems like I'm the only one. It's almost all community service. There have been some jail terms, which could be considered the grossly offensive, the racist ones, and the without knowing what sort of, quote, and I use quotes, jokes about April Jones. It's, I mean, it's not the same as it would be in the U.S., where free speech is taken very seriously. But they do have, I mean, this goes all the way back to a 1935 law about threatening or offending people by mail. And that also is reflected by modern terminology to mean the social medias.
But, I mean, see, the thing is that, again, and I guess I am the free speech advocate here, but, I mean, again, I think there is a certain – most people, when they get on Facebook, feel like they are talking to buddies. And they're down at the pub. I mean, there's sort of that down at the bar feel to it that you just say whatever's on your mind. And if people don't like it, then they say something back, and it's sort of the social back and forth.
See, and that's something I've always disagreed with because, I mean, my long experience on electric media, all the way back to the BBS days, is that they feel that they can get away with a lot more than they can. I mean, if you're talking smack down in the public bar, yeah, you get punched in the nose.
Well, yes.
Here you've got a layer of anonymity, which allows you to say whatever the heck you want, feeling that you're not going to have any sort of repercussions.
Well, but if you're
which
on Facebook.
Which is why I think that the shaming works so well, at least in terms of like bringing that reality check back to you. And that we now you're suddenly accountable for what you're saying. Like if you're hanging out with your friends and you're all standing in the room and you say something really, really, you know, tasteless and somebody turns around and slaps you in the face, like they all know you said it. It's like I don't see, like, I mean, it's like, I don't see if you are behaving as a person should behave in a socially acceptable situation that, you know, either you can get up and say, oh yeah, I said that, my bad. Or you say, you know, like, or you don't say the things that you know are extremely socially unacceptable or, you know, like, it, you know, at least if you are accountable, if you are being held accountable for what it is you are saying and what it is you are doing, then suddenly people have this, will, you know, stop behaving in such a, well, some people will stop behaving in a socially unacceptable manner. But it's like until they have that layer of anonymity kind of pulled out from underneath them going, oh my God, people actually know that I'm a douchebag. Uh-oh. You know, they continue to behave in very unacceptable fashions.
But
and let's also remember,
the UK is different because these are things where people are posting on Facebook. And so there's no anonymity on Facebook. your name is on there. So
some of them are Facebook. Now, let's also remember that some of these weren't just – if they were a single post, I could see a little bit of a problem with some of the things that are occurring. But some of these have gone past that to the point of harassment, meaning they've continually done this and done it over and over. I know that in the case of Joshua Cryer, the one who was racially abusing soccer player Stan Collymore, he boasted to friends that he had, quote, found a new hobby, his hobby being harassing this person. So at that point, if even here in the States, there have been cases made about harassment, online harassment.
But
well, it's like online bullying. It's the same idea. It's like there's this huge outcry about bullying. It doesn't stop when you turn like 18 or something. Bullying can continue even to your and through being an adult. And it's simply another form of that. At least that's how I kind of like I view it. I mean, it suddenly turns into the more serious crime of harassment.
Okay.
It's like it goes from being bullying to harassment.
But remember, there was a previous article there about Paul Chambers, who posted a joke about blowing up the local airport because he was frustrated with the service he got there. Now, is that a good idea for something to say in these days?
Try doing that in line at the TSA.
Yeah, at the TSA.
You'll find out just how good of an idea that is.
Yes, but yeah. If I'm at the bar and I say I'm going to blow up the local airport, TSA agents don't come in and arrest me.
But there's times and places. But if you post something where you say that you're going to do that, then that, even under the laws of the United States, that becomes a terroristic threat.
Yeah.
And that becomes actionable and a criminal offense.
I think that particular phrase is just sort of like a sign of the times. It's just sort of like that's like if you kind of look at it from like 9/11 up, it's like this is just this escalation towards that sort of thing.
I'm going to kill that kid. I'm going to kill him.
Yeah.
Right. And it's also because of who it's made against. I mean, there have been you can go through and say, I'm so frustrated at football player X because he screwed this up. I would just want to kill him. But if you said, I am so frustrated against President, what's his name? I want to kill him. At that point, that becomes a Secret Service thing and you can be pulled in. Well, so, I mean, even, there's always going to be times and places.
Technically, the threat of against the football player could be made. That's a death threat, mm-hmm. and a threat against their person, property, or livelihood, and that becomes a criminal offense. Now, the others calling somebody the C word, that's or saying that they think that soldiers who died in Afghanistan should die and go to hell, those are opinions, and that's the difference between making a specific threat, whether you mean it or not, whether you're saying it out of frustration or not, but it is a specific threat against a specific target, or you're making jokes about a missing girl. The difference is that you're threatening action against one. Another one, you're making a horribly tasteless comment about another.
But, yeah.
And that's the big difference between the two. And I think that's where the circumstances that this article is talking about in the UK does go too far, is that you're trying to apply one standard to another, and the two don't fit. They're not the same, because you can say all the horrible nasty jokes about a missing girl who's probably been killed, but that's not going to possibly be something that's going to cause the death of hundreds of people when an airport concourse collapses.
Any threat against, I mean, if it comes down to threats, I mean, actual threats, the law does need to step in. And if it comes down to where it's a matter of frustration, then the thing can be blown over,
the
whatever.
The problem is the law then becomes a tool for people to harass other people, because we all say inartful things at times. We all have those moments where we say something stupid and out of turn. Now, maybe not to this level, but we're all there at one point or another. And if every time, every post, we have to worry about the government breaking down our door because it may be implied we're threatening someone, that's not a society I want to live in. I would much rather live with the assholes. I'd much rather live with the assholes than to live in a society where the government can arrest me for saying something stupid.
Well, I mean, make sure to never move to Great Britain then. But we're going to go ahead and, Marie, I'm going to give you the last word on this topic, and then we're going to go on to our next topic of discussion. You got anything else to say on this?
I think the UK is a bit on the extreme, at least as far as the, like, you know, sort of policing the thing is going. I do think there are probably instances like where there are like severe harassment or threats or bullying where maybe the law should be stepping in to alleviate the trolling. And on terms of the Reddit one, it's definitely an interesting basically like two forms of privacy invasion. So it'll be interesting to see how they decide to continue to deal with this sort of thing. I think it's really would be really helpful for services to look at fast ways of dealing with like complaints of the nature of these sort of groups. Just to investigate them to at least, you know, not make people want to go and be vigilantes and they feel that they're actually being heard might help with some of the frustration of some of at least the women on some of these pictures and things of removing content that has been asked to be removed. But anyway, that's what I think anyway.
I think that's what a lot of us are going to think about it. So let's go ahead and go on. We're running short on time, so I'm going to bring up one last topic, and that is on the new think tank website from Peraza and Govar. That's right. Yeah, I can hear the sigh in everybody's voice.
Really? Do we need a think tank for this?
Well, this is coming from artist Daniel Govar, who worked on Eclipse, Azure, and False Positive, and former DC, Marvel, and Comixology executive Ron Peraza, who have launched a new website called Think Tank that will look at digital comics created for the online and tablet environments.
You know, whenever I hear the phrase former Marvel or DC exec, I reach for my Smith & Wesson. Yeah. It's just like, man, these guys are just they don't get webcomics. They never did. I see this a lot in a certain organization that I'm a member of. These guys think we've got to figure out how to monetize the web. When what they're really saying is we've got to figure out a way to protect our phony baloney profits Blazing Saddles, we have to protect our phony baloney jobs here. That's exactly what this is. They see the handwriting on the wall that these independents, that the web has enabled the barriers of entry to come down, and they're trying to figure out ways to keep rolling the windows up.
And now, I mean, I will say a think tank on webcomics, if it included some of the people like Gabe and Tycho from Penny Arcade, or I hate to say it, even Scott Kurtz or some of the other people at webcomics.com, or some Pete Abrams over at Sluggy Freelance, some of the people who have been around for a long while,
as long as my arm of people that would be great on this. And you notice that these aren't webcomics people. It's like back when podcasting came out and all of the broadcast networks were trying to figure out, well, how can we get our mitts on this so we can continue to control it?
Yeah, I think a think tank for these guys is almost a good idea if it was an actual think tank in that they bring in people and know.
That's branding. That's all. That's the name.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's turn ourselves into stuff that other people are already doing.
Yeah.
Xanapax free comics reader. Yeah. Do we really need a reader? Yeah, we've got one. It's called Comics Press.
It's called HTML.
It's called a JPEG.
Exactly. We've already. That's the thing is that they think that they're trying to get this across as we're trying to figure out how to monetize the comics. Well, guess what? People like David Kellett and Robert Kuz have figured out how to monetize comics, and Bill Holbrook and Sluggy and Pete Abrams. There again, like I said, Jenny Breeden. There are so many people who are making a living In spite of what Stefan Pasta says, you know, I know Stefan, we don't have time to really go into that, but it does kind of dovetail in with the comments that he made. These people are making their livings because this is their sole job, and they have to be making a living. They have to be making money, so they have to figure this out. Yeah. And the thing that is unique about it is that there's no one model that works for everybody. Everybody's going to be different. They're going to have different demographics, different audiences, and again, this is going to disappear, just like everything else that has come from the top down, like this. Whenever you see an exec involved, a creative executive's purpose, he does things for the same reason a dog marks territory, and he does it usually in the same way.
Yeah. I thought it was because they were so full of crap, but
I want to have a few few arguments with you here
to show that they're there.
Yeah, I mean, you are absolutely right. I mean, I was looking at this. I'm like, okay, a think tank. Maybe this is a good idea for them. They get some good people in there. They actually talk about how this works. And I gotta say, the web changes so fast. So the way webcomics worked yesterday is not the way they work today, not the way they work tomorrow.
And so
a think tank and someone saying, okay, let's look at how it's worked in the past and let's see what we can do to build upon this model, would be great. But
we need an institute of webcomics what we need. Exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Continue doing research and continue consulting and reporting on what's happening and how we need that.
Yes, that would be great.
Excellent idea.
Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up because we're running out of time. I just want to say that I went over to their website, and it's basically a WordPress site for self-advertisement for these two. I'm not really seeing anything about discussion. I'm seeing a news as to what they're doing. And some of this other stuff, there is nothing that is think tankish about this site as of yet.
Right.
Who knows what's going to happen with it? But on that point, I want to go ahead and thank everybody who joined us. I want to go ahead and thank Eric Kimball.
Thank you, Tom.
And you can find his work over at bladebunny.com. I want to thank Marie Terry.
Yay.
Who's, of course, joins us from evilspacecat.com. I want to thank from Accidental Centaurs, John Lotshaw.
Thank you. It's been more fun than humans should be allowed to have.
Well, it's a good thing that we don't limit ourselves then.
In spite of the fact that Tom was on the show.
And
we got to have one swipe at you, Tom. We haven't done it all show.
I know. I also want to thank Ben Carver for joining us, and I'll give our final goodbyes to Alex Heberling, and also thank our news editor, Jason Strasberg, for rounding up a lot of the news that we have today. And that leaves me. I'm your host, Thomas Revor from 910 Comics. It's 910cmx.com. And we'll see you in the funny papers.
Well, hang on. Before you go, the crew of the Webcomic Beacon newscast this week ended up staying late after the show and had further discussion, and here it is.
Here's the thing. When I am much more positive about Marvel executives and DC executives than you are, because I do think these guys want to keep their job.
And I think there
can theoretically be a place for them in webcomics.
And I'm not saying there's not. Just as I've always said that there's a place in webcomics for the syndicates.
Yeah.
I saw
this. I'm like, oh wow, this is really interesting because this is. I mean, this guy did do Zuda, and I mean, Zuda was a disaster, but he seemed kind of like he cared.
Well, let me go ahead and say correct you on one thing, because they don't always want to move their keep their jobs. A lot of them are making lateral moves over to a different company where they can propagate the same type of stuff.
If all companies are sinking into the ground, they want to keep their job.
When I said they want to keep their job, so I'm not talking about the specific position that they occupy at that point in time. I'm saying they want to keep the power, the income that they've got coming in, regardless of where it's coming from. It's just that this thing just reeks of suits. This thing smells like something that would come out of Cartoon Network. Smells of corporate.
It's a bunch of people who don't really know the business, but know something similar to the business, shoehorning in, saying, "Well, we don't know the business, so we're going to talk about the business, even though we don't know anything about this business." And
we're going to show you how to do what you've been doing for the last 10 years. That's the part that just drives me nuts about whenever I see a story like this.
Yeah,
is like we've been here, we've been in the trenches, and then all of a sudden they come in and they want to be the officers, and they're the ones telling us how to go over the top and go. Go over the top.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, who are you? Where did you come from? It's, having some young, in a wartime situation, having some, young lieutenant fresh out of ROTC telling these guys who've been in Iraq and Afghanistan for the last 2 years how to do their jobs.
But listen to the grizzled old sergeants who have been in the trenches rather than the young lieutenant fresh out of academy.
Exactly. When the conventional wisdom, the smart ones, do it the other way around. And so, if they make anything out of this, good for them. I'm happy for them. Welcome to the great thing about this is that webcomics is not a zero-sum game like. And that's the thing that they're going to learn. It's not a zero sum game like newspaper syndication or comic books are, where for one book to make it into the print schedule, another one has to be dropped, or for one strip to get on the page, another one's got to be pulled.
Well,
it's not a zero sum game. There's room for everybody.
They sort of are suffering from the comiXology bump. Because what happened, I mean, comiXology is something that really kind of messed up their thinking with this.
It did. It
because
messed it up really big.
We were doing webcomics for a while, and they said, we don't know how to do this. And then the iPhone came on around, which allowed much stricter control of content, which they said, oh, geez, that's great. You know, and then comiXology came along, and they had an app. And you had to go through comiXology, and you had to pay comiXology money. And
comiXology is the new diamond.
Yeah, and all of a sudden they're looking at that and they say, oh my God, that's what we want to do. We want to control publication.
Exactly.
Except comiXology is linked to the iPhone, which is kind of fading a little bit, and it's kind of, I mean, I think comiXology's time, it will fade after a while. I mean, I can't see this model lasting forever.
What the industry needs, as you know, you were very dead on in comparing comiXology to the new diamond. Yeah. What the comics industry needs and what webcomics needs, because I do believe that there is a digital devices, iOS, Android put together are going to be, that's the new frontier for us. What we need is, we don't need a new diamond. We need a new Lulu. We need an open publishing where you may have to pay a little bit to get the distribution, but there's no gatekeepers. Lulu, there's no gatekeepers. If you want to do whatever you want to do, you open up an account. Lulu takes their cut and for the manufacturing and for their expertise in getting that done. They handle the distribution. They handle all of that. What we need is somebody to basically do what comiXology is doing, but do it with more of the Lulu content model, where they don't care about the content. They're just providing the service. And I think that's something that we need, because, again, you're right. You've got this one gatekeeper with comiXology that has become the super successful way for them of doing it, and has become a monopoly just like Diamond is. And trying to get a book in Diamond, you have to offer up your firstborn
to
do it.
comiXology is bound. I mean, there is this current move with comiXology saying, oh, we're going to open it up now, because I think comiXology sees the writing on the wall for themselves. They're bound to the superhero DC Marvel genre. And if this genre crashes, then they are nothing anymore. I mean,
absolutely, absolutely. But here's the difference between this open thing that they're talking about and what I'm talking about is in the article they say that it's going to have to pass by their review board.
Right.
And again, that's the gatekeeper. That's the gatekeeper right there. So if they don't like your art, they don't like your content, then you're not going to get through. What we need is someone that Lulu has nothing like that. CreateSpace has nothing like that. That's we need a digital version of that.
Isn't there a place for gatekeepers though? I mean, isn't there a place for saying our stuff is of high quality? I mean, even back in the day with Keenspot, that was one of the selling points of Keenspot. You know, the comics here aren't crap.
They were.
Well, a lot of them were. They were better. They were better than the line art drawn by 12-year-olds that were popular in webcomics.
They were the best of the crap.
Yeah.
Well, even the bad art, I mean, because quite frankly, I mean, you can look at Order of the Stick. I mean, stick figures, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
And
it's not about the art. It's about, you know, about the overall content.
The overall quality, yeah.
Now, yes, there. You know, you can make a case for that, but I think that the marketplace can make those kinds of decisions. And if you're not making the sales, then you're going to eventually lose interest and you're going to stop doing it.
Except the marketplace argument is breaking down because there's so much stuff out there now. I mean, and this is a conversation I've had with other people. I mean, it used to be if you put out a good comic, you know, what happened was you got noticed by one famous person, you know, one of the big leaguers. They quote linked to you, and then everyone else linked to you as well because you were the new thing. You know, and you all of a sudden have this viral transmission of your comics. I can list off about 30 comics that are well drawn with good stories and good art that go nowhere. That just are not.
There's always going to be somebody that has great art, great story, should be a much, much more prominent cartoonist than they are.
But
I mean, and I know somebody.
Yeah.
And. Tom knows who I'm talking about, who has been doing comics for over 25 years. He's one of the best gag writers out there. He's been consistent. His artwork never wavers. In fact, it's just gotten more streamlined and better over the years. And he's only in 25 newspapers.
Oh, stop it. I'm blushing.
and he should be a much more prominent cartoonist than he is.
But
so this has always been the case.
Yeah, but here's the thing. On the web, we used to have, and I mean, always been the case on the web means within the last 3 months. You know.
We're talking internet time here.
Yeah, so. Internet time. But, I mean, we haven't had a real blowout success webcomic, and I think since Kate Beaton. That's the last one, and she's about 3 years old now.
And her art is terrible.
Yeah, well, you know, you can argue art and all that, but I mean, there hasn't been another blow. It used to be it was like 6 months, like clockwork. Every 6 months, another webcomic got noticed, rocketed to the top. And then all of a sudden, we're not having this because there's just too much stuff. There's too much stuff for people to filter through anymore. I mean, it really feels like we've reached some sort of limit.
Yeah, I mean, I made the comment about the black and white explosion back in the 80s. I mean, how many variations of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were coming out in 87?
Oh, a million, and they were all terrible.
Yeah, that caused the downfall of
black and white. The original.
Yeah.
Well, I also think, like, there's another thing, too, is, like, linking seems to be dead.
Yeah.
Like, really? It's dead. Nobody links to shit anymore unless it's, like, a passing mention on, like, Twitter or Facebook or something.
Yeah.
It's like, unless you're already in those social circles, you're not getting linked. Like, the big comics don't link to people anymore.
Yeah.
So they don't share the love.
I think you kind of touched on the reason for it is I think there's some blame that can be laid at the feet of the social networks. The cartoonists are thinking, I don't need to do this anymore. I've got a social network that will do it for me.
Yeah, but I mean, see, this is the thing. You know, we can talk about, oh, we have the webcomic model, but all of a sudden the webcomic model isn't working because no one's linking to stuff anymore.
Well, the webcomic model never really worked, except in rare cases. There are the exceptions, but for the vast majority of it, I mean, people can go through and say, well, we did this, this, and this. As much as I loved some of the stuff that came out in it, How to Do a Webcomics book from Brad Geiger and the others there, it was do it our way, and yeah. Even then you're not guaranteed of doing it. And it was a very narrow path that doesn't always – that almost never works. They just happen to have the perfect storm of the right thing at the right time with the right people and the right chemistry.
And other circumstances like Penny Arcade, that was a major success, not because of Gabe and Tycho, but because of Robert Coos and his business acumen.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, Penny Arcade and PvP, really, I mean, they weren't pulling themselves up with bootstraps. This is why I admired people like Randy Mulholland or Pete Abrams or Anne, because it was a pull yourself up by the bootstraps. The quote, big ones, PvP and Penny Arcade, didn't do that. They wrote on somebody else's coattails until they made it big and decided they didn't need them anymore.
Right. But we don't have, I mean, if let's say someone is starting off a webcomic today and they want to become famous, no one links to anything anymore. No, and there are a ton of different comics all coming out every time a bell rings, a webcomic is created at this point. Isn't this the time that gatekeepers are now needed?
John, you've heard me talk at comic panels. What is the first piece of advice I always give anyone who wants to create a successful webcomic nowadays?
Don't.
Well, I mean, the first piece of advice I always give is invent the time machine, go back 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a saturated market right now.
But yeah, but
it is a very saturated market. I'm getting ready to launch something at the first of the year, and I'm really heavily debating whether I'm going to launch it on the web or I'm just going to go ahead and launch it as a digital app, as an app for iOS and Android, as opposed to putting it as a serialized piece on the web.
Well, I mean, but wouldn't this problem go away? Let's say Marvel and DC, you know, unwedged their heads from their buttocks and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to go out there and we are going to sponsor webcomics. We're going to really put this into it. We're going to get a bunch of young Turks here. They're going to make their webcomics. We're going to pick the best of the best. We're not going to do any stupid games like we did on Zuda. We're going to put it up in plain text HTML. We're not going to try to make a special viewer that you have to download and install on your computer. We're just going to use the same technology that webcomics use, but we are going to sponsor it. We're going to put our name and advertising budget behind it, and this is going to be our webcomic effort. Wouldn't that get a lot of attention? And yes, wouldn't that really rocket those comics to success? And couldn't they build off of that?
It would, but you have to remember that that's not the business that DC and Marvel are in.
Right. Everything
DC and Marvel
is own the properties completely.
Exactly. Own the properties and monetize those properties. Marvel makes more money from the movie contracts than they do from the books. For example, the My Little Pony story, you mentioned Uncanny X-Men. What's the sales figures for Uncanny X-Men? 40,000 copies?
Yeah.
Maybe? Okay. So 40,000 copies at $4,000 a piece, $4 a piece, because that's the going price for a comic book these days, I think. It's been so long since I've been over to the comic book store, my comic book guy is going to kill me because I got a ton of books that I'm supposed to pay him for. So $4 times 400,000,
yeah,
and that's $1.6 million. Then you cut that in half because you have to get those out through Diamond and they want it at half price.
And so about that's another 75% out of that for materials. I mean, the cost of paper has gone up. The cost of ink has gone up.
So I agree. They don't make money.
They're not making money off the comic books. The comic books are a loss leader,
right?
In a way,
it's the same thing. I mean, take a look at Penny Arcade. Penny Arcade doesn't make money off their comics. They make it off of all the crap they do, and they've made themselves a name.
But why can't Marvel do the same thing? Why can't they own the webcomics they sponsor? I mean, why can't they say, okay, we're going to create, let's say they say...
Wasn't that kind of the point of having like a label, like of a label, like some of the collectives like that have tried to come together is like they're trying to create like a group of high quality comics that update regularly and all that jazz. But what seems to happen is there's no way to go broad enough to encompass a large enough stable of these creators and also babysit them. I mean, let's face it, artists are nuts.
Yeah, we're talking about cartoonists here, yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the egos. Let's use Keen as an example. I mean, Keen Spot was doing very well, and then the Crosby Brothers egos just exploded, and they started wanting to own everything that went through Keen. And a lot of the people, the creators, said, I don't want to sign over my rights.
Okay, but see, that was the problem. The problem they have there is if you go to a successful webcomic and say, hey, successful webcomic, which you're making an income off of this property, sign over your property to us. That's never going to fly. That's stupid. If you go to an artist, you know, or a creator who hasn't created anything yet, say, okay, you've got this idea. It sounds like a good idea. We're going to sponsor it. We're going to pay you a living wage. You'll be on a work-for-hire contract, but you'll get health insurance. You'll be part of the company. And if it goes, you know, if it goes huge, there'll be things in our contract where you get percentages of movies and all that sort of nice stuff. We're not screwing you out of it, but we own the IP. And, and if you start flaking out, guess what? We're going to replace you with someone who actually does the job.
You know what, Tom? Your analogy, your webcomic panel thing that you said about the time machine.
Mm-hmm.
You need to change that because what Eric's talking about is not going back 15 years; it's going back 75 years, and because that's the model that the syndicates had up until the mid 80s. Where Charles Schulz did not own Peanuts. Peanuts was owned by United Feature Syndicate, and he was paid on a percentage basis. There was a 50-50 split between the syndicate, and that was the typical syndicate split, 50-50 for whatever the syndicate took in.
Well, and take a look at go back 45 years. This is the type of deal that Jack Kirby and the others had over at Marvel. Marvel owned everything; they were just getting a paycheck.
And
for all the work and all the creativity they did. The only thing that the Kirby Estate owns is Captain America.
Now there's two things here. First of all, you can make a better contract so that it doesn't screw the creator completely. But still gives the company ownership of the IP to develop it into movies and other properties. You can make a contract that does that.
Even then,
there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is it has to do with the ownership of the property. Yeah. And because if let's say that you've got a comic strip and you were given this deal, and I'm actually speaking from experience of people that I know, you were given a deal where the syndicate bought the intellectual properties from you. You were working on a work for hire basis with them. And so now you are dependent upon them to go out and sell that property.
Right.
And now here's what happened with in this experience. The syndicate went out and sold the property. It had a very strong launch. And then that was the end of it. That was the end of the effort that the syndicate put into the strip. Meanwhile, the artist is plugging away, generating strips and working on it, developing it, continuing it. And what it was 300 newspapers has dropped down to 50,
right?
And it will never go up,
but
because the syndicate has no, even though the syndicate owns it, they own that property. They have no interest whatsoever in because it's too much effort to go out and try to convince somebody to pick up a 25-year-old feature, or try to develop something, to develop movies or anything out of it. We've obviously I am talking about my friend Bill Holbrook.
Yeah. And well, let's take a different example, because we've got two examples that we can use. I mean, one is somebody who did it right, but who had been playing the game for a long while and went out and created a comic strip to be marketed, but made sure he owned all the marketing rights and merchandising rights. And that's the very savvy Jim Davis.
I mean, actually, Jim Davis did not own the rights. When he started, it was under the typical syndicate contract where he bought, where he owned nothing. He was work for hire. The syndicate, United Features Syndicate, owned Garfield. He was able to get to the point where he was able to buy out his own contract from, because Garfield was so phenomenally successful. And then he was able to take it to Universal. So he had jumped syndicates before United Features imploded. So Jim Davis is not the example you want to use, because he did not own the strip initially. He had to buy it back from the syndicate. And there's been many cartoonists who have had to do that. Lynn Johnston had to buy back for better or worse.
Yeah.
The Scholes family bought back Peanuts.
Well, let me use my other one, and the fact is that we've had something like that. Remember what Zooda started off as, right? Even before the whole reader thing, but it started off as, you know, DC Comics is sponsoring web comics.
Well, right.
And the little thing where you sketch your idea down. And what was the reaction to that?
I'll tell you, there were two reactions. There was a reaction of, oh, that's horrible. You're stealing the IP. That, you know, that's not how web comics were done. And then when Zooda launched, people were falling all over themselves to get into Zooda. And I think,
because it was DC.
Yeah, because it was DC. And I think that there are two sides to this. I think that, yes, it would be difficult it's difficult to convince people, but owning the IP is very beneficial for the company. And I know that syndicates didn't develop their IP, but I think that's sort of the problem with the syndicates, because if you look at what the comic books did, you know, what do they make money off of? Movies. TV series, ancillary items, and they invest in this.
And actually, you're going to start seeing that. Popeye is Genndy Tartakovsky's next project, and that's owned by King Features. Blue Sky Studios has just signed a deal with the Scholes family to do a new Charlie Brown Peanuts animated film.
I thought that no more Peanuts stuff was going to be coming out after the death of Scholes.
No. What's not gonna, no new comic strips. Scholes was always very clear that the comic strips and everything else were two completely different animals. He would allow other artists to work on the greeting cards, the comic books. The comic books were completely ghosted by several artists that he picked out and trained. But the only person that ever did the comic strip itself was Sparky. And he said, I don't want any more comic strips after I put down my pen. And that's been the case. And I think that will continue to be the case, but because the family is in control now. But the animated specials, the MetLife ads, all of that, Sparky always considered that to be separate and not real Peanuts. And if you want to keep doing those after I'm gone, fine. Just leave the comic. That was mine. Leave the comic strip to me.
To bring it back to webcomics, though, I mean, to bring it back, we now have a situation with webcomics where you have a obscene amount of talents sloshing around on the web who want to get paid, who want to get noticed, and you have companies that have names and have advertising budgets that could get a property noticed and to build it up, and then could build it up to high profitability. It seems like it is now time for the gatekeepers to come and do something, if they would stop screwing around with trying to reinvent JPEGs because they don't like the idea that anyone could just download it, you know, and that sort of stuff.
They're also, I think they also too, like there's a lot of concern regarding risk in terms of, like, you know, we're going to pick a property, what guarantees it is successful, which is why they tend to go after the ones that are already successful. If you can get yourself noticed, oh, well, then no problem. We know that you're a successful property. No, people will buy this. They just don't have that insight to pick the next biggest thing.
I mean, that's why Rob Liebfeld keeps getting, you know, richer.
But
we had to get one Liebfeld swipe in.
Yeah, but the thing is, comics are cheap.
I mean, if you're going to talk about risk, what's more risky, going out with a new movie or putting a comic on the web where there is zero distribution cost?
Well, there's zero risk in movies. Look at what is being developed, and it's all based. Just about everything is based on properties that are already proven.
Right.
I mean, do you think that Avengers would have gotten greenlit if it was a fresh off the typewriter, over the transom script submission? Hell no.
No, but
it got submitted. It got greenlit. It got Joss Whedon attached because it was already based on all of these other properties that had been going since the 1960s and had really started showing strength since in the last 5 years, since the Marvel movie universe really geared up.
But, I mean, look at, for example, Kick-Ass. That was a property that didn't exist, you know, and we just made a comic for the specific purpose of creating a movie. And we went out there and marketed the comic, built up the comic, proved that the comic worked, and then that gave us the leverage to make a movie out of it. Why can't you do that with webcomics?
Because remember, who did Kick-Ass? These were proven, known commodities in the entertainment industry. These people were already known for the comics work that they'd already done, so they had a track record already.
Movie okay, am I coming through?
You're coming through, fine. Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't there just a moment ago.
Oh, okay.
but they're not gonna take a chance on you or me because we don't have that track record. But Mark Millar did,
right? And that's really what it also comes down to. It's not what you know; it's who you know, and too many things.
Exactly.
But that's like going all the way back to the other part of the beginning discussion is talking about, you know, you're a new artist. You could be insanely talented, but, you know, you start a webcomic because that's the only outlet you have because nobody will hire you.
Exactly.
So it's like this total catch-22. You can't get noticed unless you've been hired. You can't get hired until you get noticed. So it's like, you know.
It's always been. That's the way it has always been.
Yeah, well, but it's like...
And then there are still a few things. I mean, a lot of the people who get hired nowadays are coming out of the Kubert School. Because that's a name that's a known quantity. If you graduate from the Kubert School, you are already known to have talent.
The Kubert School is to comics what USC Film School was to filmmaking in the 70s.
Yeah.
It's the proving grounds where you show... If you've got the what it takes to get in there to begin with, and you show that you've got the chops and you gain the chops, so when you come out, they're sitting there waiting for you. They're not going to be waiting for you if you come out of Dalton State College in Dalton, Georgia.
And a lot of the people who are writing comics nowadays, take a look at who they are. They're television movie screenwriters.
Yeah,
it's not people who have come up through the ranks. You know, the days of a Roy Thomas or a Marv Wolfman, or a Jim Shooter, are long gone.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a process that has been going on for a long time with comics, and you can see it in the encroachment of Hollywood over at San Diego.
Yeah,
it parallels that perfectly.
And but where does that leave webcomics then? I mean, are webcomics ever going to be a path to Hollywood, or are they always just going to be a resume building exercise?
I think it's like anything else. It's like it's been proven that it can be a path to Hollywood, but it's those rare few. You know, you have the magic combination of perfect storm of stuff.
Well, then where does that leave DC and Marvel when Diamond collapses and the direct market collapses?
See, they'll have no problem because they already have an infrastructure set up. To where if Diamond were to disappear tomorrow, Marvel and DC would not lose a step.
DC has already shown that where their interests are. They moved their headquarters from New York to Hollywood.
Yeah.
The whole rebranding of DC Comics has been to make it more cinema friendly branding, and Marvel has really taken the lead on that. And being aggressive with the branding, and now that they're owned by Disney, once those contracts are all expired.
A good example, take a look at Daredevil. Fox had Daredevil, And because they didn't do anything with the property in time, the rights have now reverted back to Marvel, and Marvel's going to be adding Daredevil into the stable of the Marvel comic movies.
But that's all based on having a stable of property as it gets older. So doesn't that... Hold on a second. Those look fine, so you can use them.
Okay. Y'all know Sorry. Me. I'm the maverick. I'm a firm believer in the webcomics, and the webcomics can be the future. But the old guard are going to be... I mean, they're not just slow to change. They're glacial.
But, I mean, doesn't this leave them in a... I cannot see in 10 years there being a comic book market. I cannot see that.
No, it'll evolve into something else.
There will still be a comic book market. It will still be will be a print comic book market. People will still want to buy that. It'll be even more niche than it is now. But I do believe there will still be a comic book market.
Doesn't that mean there are no new properties coming from that market?
Not necessarily. A lot of it are going to be the new properties, quote unquote. A lot of them are going to be reworkings of old properties. What DC has done with Earth 2, you know, rebranding and remarketing the Golden Age stuff and royally fucking it up. Excuse my language, please. But doing that, they have no new ideas. Hollywood has no new ideas, but they have what sells.
They have new ideas. It's just new ideas from the, from the 40s and 50s. You know, it took them a while. I mean, the comic book properties have been developed over years, but they were a new idea at one point.
I can't see them not acquiring new properties that are successful. Ones that prove themselves to be successful, they will get optioned and they will get bought or they will get... People will pick up new properties. It's just going to be a matter of that, you know, either that connection, like knowing the person who knows a person who can get you a meeting with somebody important, or it is being a universally successful and then being able to dictate your own terms.
And also a lot of it has to do with how determined are you as a creator to be successful with that property. If, I know folks who have been down this route before. And it's all how bad do you want it? Do you want to go out there and start schlepping your property around or your script, getting in the face of every possible producer in Hollywood, doing whatever it takes to get that elevator buttonhole pitch, and then staying with them until you make that sale. Most webcomic artists, most cartoonists don't have that kind of personality. That's where the syndicate in the comic books really was valuable for the properties that made that jump.
Here's my basic argument, and here's the thing I'm seeing. The old method where we got noticed through linking and through viral methods doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't work. So now we have to find a new way. And I've been looking at what other people have been doing. The way to success at this point seems to be you have to spend a ton of cash on advertising. You have to actually actively...
You have to have money to make money.
You have to spend the money on advertising. And who has a ton of cash? Well, these are the gatekeepers. Someone's going to have to come in here and say, I picked these three comics. I'm going to have some I'm going to have some payoff for their success, and I'm going to spend a ton of cash on it.
But that also comes... I mean, those who have the money are oftentimes not willing to take the risk. There has to be something about it that sparks their interest.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Just doing webcomics itself isn't going to be enough. I mean, it's... If I had the $1 million, I mean, I would do it. But I'm not a businessman. I know how to schmooze. I know how to do this stuff. That doesn't mean I like it. And I'd much rather be doing other stuff. And that's the way it is with most cartoonists. You have to have the business acumen, and you have to have the talent And you have to have personality.
Or have there a needs to be a syndicate for webcomics. It sounds like we are now at the point where we need the syndicate.
And we've had a couple of skills. Keen was originally a syndicate for webcomics, but the people in charge started the big people who sold originally walked away because they didn't like the way we were doing it, or they got their egos got too big and they felt they could do it themselves. That's how we got webcomics.com. That's how we got Blank Label. That's how we got some of these other things, because ego comes into play all too often on both sides of
this. That was also a time when that you could do that. You could walk away and say, well, I can make it on my own. It really feels like now the only way to make it is if someone comes in and pays a ton of money.
Well, it's like it's like being a part of some of these actually these labels is beneficial because of the cross promotion that's done within the label. Like if you are part of like say Spider Forest, for example, all of the comics, which are all fairly, you know, they've been there for a while, especially if you're the new person on the block, they're going to promote your comic through their comic because they're they're all on the same team. So they're all cross promoting the comic. And because their people are coming to their website, then there's actually the linkage of old going on, but only between the comics in that one label. It's a little ecosystem. And then they pool all of their advertising resources to get the money to advertise in a larger scale in other sites.
And I'll tell you, from my experience with 910, a lot of the creators in 910, I mean, friendly people, but they just want to be left alone and do their comic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that point, speaking about which, I need to get going because it's 10:30 here and I'm tired.
I'm going to have a horrible day tomorrow, but this was an interesting conversation.
It's 8:30 and I haven't eaten anything yet. I really need to eat.
All right.
I will talk to you all later. Thanks for jumping in, John.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
It was a lot of fun talking to John.
All right. Good night.